Hi, everybody. Sorry for the delay. I've got a connectivity issue in my
recording
office.
Recording has started.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon, I should say. Sorry for the delay. I've had a connectivity issue in my office. So anyway, let's do a roll call, Jamie, and see who's here.
Justice Hardesty.
Here.
Justice Silver. I saw her up there. Justice Stiglitz.
Here.
John Ariscotta.
Here.
Judge Freeman. He's going to be late. Judge Herndon. He's also going to be late. Luke Prankeman is proxy for Christopher Hicks.
Here.
Thank you. Darren Imlay.
Here.
Mark Jackson.
Here.
Lisa Rasmussen.
Here.
Thank you. Judge Shirley.
Here.
John Springate.
Here.
Thank you. Darren Imlay as proxy for Jonelle Thomas.
Here.
And Chris Lawley as proxy for Steve Wolfson.
Here.
We do have a quorum.
Okay, thanks. Comments, questions concerning the May 27th meeting summary? Thanks, Jamie, for producing that so quickly. All right, hearing none, those will be approved. Mr. Lawley, if we could turn to tab two. Thank you for providing a follow-up amendment to the settlement conference rule. Why don't you comment for the members here, and then if you could give me an update as to what is happening in Clark County. I know Judge Freeman hasn't arrived yet, but when he does, we'll ask about that.
So, thank you, Justice. Based upon our last meeting, I had reached out to those who were involved with the settlement conference process here in Clark County, and the only recommended change that I received any feedback on was to specifically allow for a judge other than the settlement judge, but not necessarily the trial judge, to be able to accept the plea. Oftentimes, maybe late in the day, and the trial judge just isn't available. And so based upon the feedback that I received, I prepared the amendment that's at tab two. And I know that Judge Bell has resumed the settlement process here in Clark County. I don't know how many cases have actually gone through to settlement hearing, but I know that the process is resumed.
Okay, are there any questions of Mr. Lawley about the suggested edit to the rule?
And I apologize, I have a question. This is Judge Jones. I'm here for Judge Bell. I don't think Judge Herndon is coming. I think it's just going to be me. But is there a reason that the civil settlement conference thing is number one? That's on my tab two.
That the what?
On rule 252 on my tab two?
Yes, Judge Jones. This, when
I know I wasn't here, I apologize from last.
No, that's okay. When the Supreme Court enacted settlement conferences in criminal cases, Rule 252 was amended, which applied just to civil settlement conferences. So paragraph one is civil settlement conferences, and we haven't really touched that. We're only really addressing section two for criminal cases.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry, Judge Jones. Any other, for not explaining that earlier, any other questions for Mr. Lawley?
No, that was my only question.
Okay, I'd like to defer a vote until Judge Freeman joins us, unless there's another representative from the judiciary from the second district. Is there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Mr. Emley, any comment about settlement conferences in the 8th?
No, we're in agreement with the new rule, and likewise, I don't know, since settlement conferences have resumed, I don't know if any of that have gone yet, so, but we're in agreement with the proposed language.
Okay. I had one question regarding the proposed rule. If you could indulge me, Chris, it is totally consistent with our conversation in the last meeting, but it occurred to me when I read subparagraph F. Is it everyone's understanding that when the plea is taken by a judge other than the trial judge, that the trial judge may advise the parties well after the PSI has been prepared, and probably not until sentencing, that the trial judge finds this resolution unacceptable and undoes the entire arrangement. One of the benefits that we hoped to achieve before is that with the trial judge taking the plea, that particular issue was resolved. And so there'd be no additional delay in the processing of the case beyond proceeding to sentencing. Now, if a trial judge takes the, other than the settlement judge, takes the plea, and other than the trial judge, then it seems like when you get to sentencing and the trial judge announces their dissatisfaction with the negotiated sentence, that the whole thing will be undone and everybody will have been into the process, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, 60 days plus. Would it be advisable that we somehow permit the judge who's taking the plea to consult with the trial judge to make sure that this sentence is acceptable to the trial judge? We've had some problems with judge-to-judge communication, and that has been, it also creates a potential judicial conduct problem in addition to ex parte communication problems. So I don't know that that's an acceptable outcome, but I just want to point out that everybody, including the defendant, may think they have an arrangement here, and the plea's been taken, and you get to sentencing, and the trial judge is seeing all of this for the first time, and that could be a problem. Was that vetted or considered?
Justice Hardesty, I think that was considered, as you alluded to, in the original draft of the rule. And I think what you point out is very possible to happen. So the trial judge doesn't like the deal and he wants to undo it. I just think that's it. When you're going to have the flexibility of having other judges be able to take the plea, I just think that is an unfortunate consequence of how the rule would exist. But personally, I don't believe it would warrant any additional drafting changes. You know what? My thought is that could very well happen, and if it happens, so be it. But that's just my thought.
Yeah, I just want to, Darren or Mr. Petty, I want to make sure everybody's on board with the acceptance of the risk, the assumption of the risk, I should say.
Judge, John Arascana.
Yeah.
My thought is this, is I think after, you know, once the settlement is reached, it should be reduced into a writing, not the guilty plea memorandum, but in essence a term sheet, for lack of better words, and that can be provided to the trial judge who then can look at it and either express their willingness to follow the stipulations or their lack of willingness, so we don't get into that 60-day gap that you were just referencing. And also it gives both parties a clear understanding of what they agreed to during the settlement conference.
The problem is that if the trial judge were available to entertain some sort of a review like that, the trial judge would take the plea. The fact that someone else is taking the plea means the trial judge is not available. And I think
that's any
settlement.
Chris.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, Chris, I'm assuming that. What we're trying to avoid is 60 days down the road, it comes time for sentencing. I think if the judge says I'm not going to follow it, then under the rule that the defendant can withdraw from the plea agreement.
Correct.
So why not reduce to writing, as in essence a term sheet of this is what the parties agreed to, and both parties have that, and it's forwarded to the trial judge to either express his acceptance or rejection of the stipulation, so we avoid that 60-day window that Justice Hardesty was just referring to.
John, I guess the question is, when do you foresee that happening? So what
the email sent that day.
So what normally happens, or and what has been happening, is we go through the settlement process, a settlement is reached, and that same day, a plea is entered. So it happens right when the defendant and the parties come to an agreement. So to say, hey, we're going to send the trial judge an email and let the trial judge review that, if the trial judge isn't available to accept the plea, the trial judge isn't going to review that email, presumably, for a day or two. If these are done on Fridays, which they sometimes are, that means we're not taking a plea until the following week. And for us, at least in Clark County, the beautiful thing is we get to a plea rather quickly.
Chris, I get it. I think we're two ships passing in the night right now. It's just under a situation where the judge who takes the plea is not the trial judge, and there's stipulated sentencing that's been agreed upon. We don't want to have the plea taken and then the PSI prepared, and then we get to the sentencing date. The way I read the rule, the defendant could still pull out of the plea agreement on the day of sentencing if the judge says he's not going to follow the stipulations. So why not just do a term sheet of the agreement as it occurs and get that to the trial, judge, and he can express, or she can express their agreement or disagreement with the stipulations within probably a 1 week period of time.
So are you talking about that?
This is Justice Sover. Can I just say that even as a district court judge, I may very well hear from the victim saying, and that's generally when I have not gone with the stipulated, it's because there's been things that have been brought out that I may not agree with. So you can send something a week or a day after, and it may look okay to the district court judge, but it's not until later when you hear everything that you decide, well, maybe I'm not going to go with that stipulated plea. I just want to put it out there. I don't know. This is going to be solved by just sending an email. That's all I'm saying.
And I'd like to weigh in too, as Justice Stiglitz. I completely agree with how we are now. I don't think we should be adding another step, another email, another piece of paper, another thing that a district judge is going to. It's fine to do it at sentencing. You have all the information then at sentencing, and if they reject it, you're back in the same place. I think it begs the bigger question, which is why does it take 60 days to get to sentencing? That, to me, that's always been a little more outrageous. It should be 30 days or whatever. So 60 is crazy. But that said, that's the system we have, or we permit. That said, if the judge rejects it at the time of sentencing when they have all the information, then they do. It's only an opportunity. And I think as Judge Herndon, with their small group, we're really committed as a group to trying to effectuate these plea agreements and these dispositions that are reached through settlement, and trying to support that program when possible. So I think adding another step will just make this more cumbersome and convoluted, and kind of dilute exactly what we're trying to do. That's just my thoughts.
Any other comments about the amendments to the rule? All right, let's take a roll call on the among the committee to pass this forward to the Supreme Court.
Okay. Justice Hardesty?
I approve the amendment as proposed.
Okay. Justice Silver? Justice Stiglitz?
I approve. I'm sorry. I couldn't figure out how to do that. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. Thank you. Justice Stiglitz?
I approve.
Thank you. John Arascotta?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Freeman is not here. Judge Herndon is not here. Luke Prengeman is proxy for Chris Hicks?
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay?
Yes.
Thank you. Mark Jackson?
Yes.
Thank you. Lisa Rasmussen?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Shirley?
Yes.
Thank you. John Springate?
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay as proxy for Jonelle Thomas?
Yes.
Thank you. And Chris Lawley as proxy for Steve Wolfson?
Yes.
Okay, the yeses have it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chris, for your work on this. Let's turn now first with regard to Rule 8H. We received another amendment and some commentary from Mr. Prengeman, and I believe Ms. Rasmussen submitted, I think Friday, another version or approach and some additional commentary. I'm going to move the further discussion on Rule 8H to the July 1 meeting of the commission. Or of the committee, and so we'll take that up as our first item of agenda on July 1. I'd like
Justice Hardesty?
Yes.
It's Mark Jackson. I'm a little bit confused. It was my understanding at our last meeting that you had requested that those memos be submitted, and that you were going to submit those three drafts straight to the Supreme Court for debate. You had also offered up that you were going to be preparing a memo explaining what your concerns were, because you still had concerns in connection with what Ms. Rasmussen, Ms. Dickinson, as well as what Mr. Prengeman had discussed and what you anticipated would be in their memo. So I don't know if you're still planning on submitting that, but this would take us back to the debate and us taking action as far as a committee. But is it your intent just to move those along to the Supreme Court or to bring it back? Because one of the things we discussed, this is always evolving. This was not decided by the court, and not that you had an opportunity necessarily in that case, but you know, to put a 12-hour window in as part of a rule where it hasn't been litigated, and I think that you're going to be getting those cases in the next year. I just think it's something that needs to be avoided. But
thank you, Mark.
I guess I just want clarification where we're going with this.
Thank you, Mark, for the question. That's a fair point. I consider this subsection of the rule unresolved at this stage. Luke had requested the opportunity to file a submission with respect to this, which I thought was appropriate. There was a motion taken, but that motion defeated the request for the previous version of the rule. I didn't consider this issue closed as a result. I felt that this was a matter that needed to be further discussed by the committee. I wanted all of the members of the committee to see what Luke's comments were and his arguments. He hadn't had an opportunity to do that at the last meeting. And I wanted everybody to be able to review and read what Ms. Rasmussen sent out on Friday. So I am postponing this for further discussion. I did express my view that if the matter was unresolved, the issues and the debate would be transmitted to the Supreme Court for their deliberation when we pass the rest of the rules. And I do have a viewpoint that I'd like to share with the committee before we do that. So I'm deferring this issue until we have that further discussion. It hasn't been foreclosed. It hasn't been resolved as far as I'm concerned. It's still open for discussion among the committee members.
Thank you, Justice.
Justice Hardesty?
Yeah.
This is John Petty. I'm just want to get some clarification. I have the Clark County proposal, and then I have what I now understand to be Luke's proposal. I was under the impression that you were going to write something too, but you have not.
I have not.
Oh, okay, thank you.
But there's a third item, John, if you don't have it, and that was another version with some, not a lot, but some legal argument from Ms. Rasmussen on Friday, I believe. Do you have that?
Oh, no, I don't have that.
I'm forwarding it.
I do not have it.
So this was, some of you may not have that, which is why I am postponing the discussion on this subsection of the rule until July 1 to give everybody an opportunity to read what's been distributed. I don't think the issue is foreclosed one way or another on Rule H.
Thank you.
Justice Hardesty, Sharon Dickinson.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you hear me? I don't know. Is it possible that we could submit additional points and authorities if we find anything?
You're welcome to do so, but I'm going to cut this off. So since the next meeting is July 1, then any commentary you may have should be submitted by this Friday.
Okay, thank you.
By either side. For those who do not recall, and to clarify my point about the last time we discussed this, the difference or the rule that we had under consideration under Mr. Pringleman's motion was simply that a motion, pretrial motions had to be made, including this detention area, in writing. That's a short version of what was essentially the rule and the subject of his motion at the last meeting. I had expressed in response to the public defender's submission and the request for a 12-hour time frame that we, at least speaking for me personally, I felt that there were some issues surrounding that time frame that required some further legal development and most likely would require some development in contested cases that may be on their way to the Supreme Court. There was one other area, and this is a reminder to me, I want to mention, and that had to do with a follow-up that I wanted to make concerning how cases arrive at the district court through grand jury indictment. And I think that all of these memos and these approaches may not take into account or may make assumptions that are not accurate with respect to what's happening when a case arrives in the district court by way of indictment. So following our meeting, I reached out to, I asked Judge Stiglitz to reach out to Judge Freeman to get, clerk of the court of the Second Judicial District to get some clarification on the delay in time that takes place from a grand jury indictment and an arrest following a grand jury indictment to the district court. And I'll let Judge Stiglitz report to the committee what she learned from that conversation. I also had an opportunity to reach out to Judge Herndon and ask him about that same question. And Judge Herndon, if you don't mind, I see you've joined the meeting, and thank you. You outlined for me that in Clark County, cases arrive in the district court through grand jury indictment, essentially three ways. And so I thought it was worthwhile for the committee to understand this, because part of the concern is the delay that takes place from an arrest of a grand jury indictment to the district court. And so speaking for someone who got the information firsthand, I'm going to ask Justice Stiglitz to share what she learned from the clerk of the court in the second district about that time frame. And then I'm going to ask if Judge Herndon would summarize for everybody the three areas in which, or three ways in which, the grand jury is being used in the 8th. And in particular, I think, Doug, you are going to reach out to Judge Bell to see what the delay is, or what the time period, I shouldn't use the word delay, but the time period is from arrest following indictment, where the only basis under which the defendant is coming to the district court in the 8th is by reason of a grand jury indictment. In other words, they haven't already been through the justice of the peace system. So first, Justice Stiglitz, do you recall that conversation with the clerk of the Second Judicial District Court?
I do, and I was trying to pull up the email. It is, we were talking, as I understand the process there, when a person is arrested on a true bill, they're brought before a district judge at the next available calendar, which usually is 1 to 2 weeks. So that is how long, as I understand it, and John Petty or anyone else can weigh in, per the clerk's office, that is how long it's taking to get in front of a district judge. And that is if somebody's on the street and arrested on a grand jury indictment. If somebody's in custody, it's still the next available criminal calendar, which kind of depends upon when the particular judge is available and doing a calendar. So 1 to 2 weeks.
Mr. Petty or Mr. Escada, is that your understanding as well?
That's my understanding. This is John Petty. That's my understanding in Washoe County.
Mr. Prehman, is that your understanding?
It is, Justice, with the caveat that the defendants coming from, who aren't arrested on the street, have already had bail set, which traditionally, at least in the second district, is rolled over when they are ad-booked on the existing, on the new warrant, and the justice court proceedings are stayed.
Well, no, I'm talking about an indictment that occurs without, when you say ad book, that's ad book after arrest.
Yeah, yes, Justice. I would say in the second, the majority of our grand jury indictments are parallel proceedings of defendants who are already in custody or have proceedings pending in the justice court. And so I don't debate the 1 to 2 week timeline, but I just wanted to, for the fullness of information, indicate that the practice here is that those defendants are not sitting for 1 to 2 weeks without bail, because the bail is rolled over onto the warrant, and so they traditionally have had bail set. So that's all I wanted to clarify.
And have they had an opportunity to have a judicial officer review the bail that was set for them following the arrest?
Yes, Justice. Now, before Valdez Jimenez, they would have had the ability with the bail to request a bail hearing, which the justice courts are fairly liberal in setting. And now they would, of course, have had a hearing pursuant to Valdez Jimenez prior to being indicted in that parallel proceeding.
Are there any cases, Luke, in which the defendant is indicted and arrested and has bail set by someone other than a judicial officer?
Not that I'm aware of, Justice. It's always either in the parallel proceedings that's been set in justice court, and then for the defendants who are arrested off the street based on the warrant of the indictment, those are set by the district court judge.
Mr. Ariscotti, do you concur?
Yes.
All right. And then, Judge Herndon, if you could share with the group our conversation.
Thank you. And before I do that, if I could, Justice Hardesty. Hey, Jamie, I was here at the last vote. I would have abstained anyway because I didn't get on the line until halfway through that discussion. So I didn't feel like I had enough information to vote anyway.
Okay, thank you.
But yes,
We did. I had a discussion after Justice Hardesty and I spoke. I had a discussion with Linda. And Justice Hardesty's right. I kind of outlined essentially three ways, not necessarily three ways that indictments get to our district court, but three ways that the defendants do. The first being just what Luke mentioned a moment ago, and it's the vast, vast majority of our cases as well, which are parallel proceedings. A defendant is arrested, they're being prosecuted in justice court, and the district attorney's office goes and seeks an indictment. The defendant is in custody, and at the time of the indictment return in district court, the judge transfers whatever bail amount was set in the lower court. Sometimes they'll raise the bail amount, and then they put the matter on the next available criminal calendar, generally, of whoever the assigned judge is going to be in district court. The second way is sometimes the state just requests a summons. So you have a defendant who's being prosecuted in justice court. He or she has made bail. The defense attorney is notified that the state's seeking the indictment. Usually there'll be some type of conversation between the attorneys, and the state will agree, and they then ask the district court judge doing the indictment return to just issue a summons and set it over in front of the district court judge to whom the case is assigned. So there's no warrant that comes out of the indictment process. And then the third is, and it's very, very rare, even in Clark County, despite our volume of cases, where somebody is indicted who is out of custody and an arrest warrant is sought for them at the indictment return, and the district court judge handling the indictment return issues an arrest warrant in whatever amount of bail that the judge is going to set. Rare enough that it was only earlier this week that I was able to finally find a case where that happened so that we could ask our IT division to create some logic so that we can start trying to go back and capture all those cases and get a sense of what the time period is between when the person is arrested and when they're getting in front of the assigned district court judge. The one that I looked at was back in March, and if I recall correctly, the indictment warrant was issued on March 23rd. The gentleman was picked up on March 24th. He posted bail that same day, but the indictment warrant, he was arrested March 23rd, and it appeared in front of the district court judge that was assigned to the case on March 30th, I believe. What I don't know is, was it set in 7 days because he posted bail, or was it set in 7 days just because that's our natural time period to set the case from an indictment return? I know, and Linda had the same reaction that I did, Justice Hardesty, when she and I spoke, that neither of us believed, and Tierra can hop in on this as well because she's done a lot of indictment returns as well. None of us believed that it was a 3 or 4 week time period between when somebody got arrested and they were making their first appearance in front of the assigned district court judge. So any indication that that was the time period that we were utilizing in Clark County, I'm not aware of that. I mean, I'm not saying there weren't cases that may have slipped through in some fashion, but from a general standpoint, I believe most of our cases, if not all of them, should be getting to their assigned court within a week or so. Now, anecdotally, like I said, I'm sure everybody can point to a case here or there where something went awry. But I believe it's going to be about that week kind of time period. But what we asked IT to do was create whatever technological, and I'm not a technology guy, capture information they needed to then go search Odyssey and pull up all those cases so that we can identify those time periods and come up with some better idea of what our historical average is.
So thank you very much, Judge. I appreciate the input. Judge Jones, did you want to offer anything in addition from your own experience?
I don't have anything in addition. I agree with Judge Herndon. Most of the time, it's like about 5 to 7 days, and we do, most of us have calendars at least 2 times a week, sometimes 3, so we can usually accommodate that in a week or most like 7 days.
Okay, so
hey, Tierra, I'm sorry, Justice Hardesty, while Tierra's speaking, I wanted to ask her because I didn't get a chance to talk to her about this. Your belief, I think, is probably going to be the same as mine and Linda's, though, that once somebody's arrested on the indictment warrant, the only way we know about it is the detention center notifies us that the person's been picked up so we can create the court date, right?
Yes, that is my understanding. They notify us and the clerk's office places it on calendar.
Got it, okay.
So I wanted to have this information in front of the committee to provide context to the debate that's taking place under Rule 8H. Because when one has the context in which we're talking about this, it is important to realize a couple of things. Most, if not all but maybe one or two minor cases are being reviewed in the context of which a judicial officer has already weighed in on the defendant's detention status and or made bail, either based on a bail schedule. So when we're talking about the time frame within which a district court should be considering these motions under Rule 8H, it should be in that context. And I wanted to have us operating under the facts of what's taking place and not comparing the district court's review of this with the same kind of urgent time constraints that we see in justice court. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the 72-hour rule, for example, that's statutory in justice court, or even the 48-hour rule that's recognized in some case law, isn't something that shouldn't be considered. But what I am saying is that a prompt adjudication expected under Valdez in the district court is essentially a prompt adjudication of someone or a prompt review of someone's detention status that has already been in front of a judicial officer at least once and maybe more than once. So when I read arguments about the state has no time to prepare for a 12-hour hearing in district court, or I read arguments about this has to be done in 12 hours from the defense side, that because this is so urgent that the defendant hasn't had any consideration about their detention status, those arguments fall on deaf ears to me. Again, I'm only speaking for myself, but I am very concerned about that we operate with respect to these rules in the context of the facts and what's taking place. So this is part of, Mark, why I wanted to defer this until July 1, because I think when you're talking about these rules, we need to think about this. There's one other thing I want to refer everybody's attention to if you haven't already seen it. And that is, on June the 3rd, the legislature's pretrial detention committee that is studying bail reform in the state heard presentations on this very issue from Ms. Lemke, and I forget the name of her colleague, I apologize. And I believe also some arguments from the DA's office. The point I wanted to make is, and it gets back to a point I made in the previous discussion on this, the time frame within which the district court should be operating, I think, is deserving of a rule so that people are operating within certain time frames. Now, in that June 3rd meeting, there was a debate similar to what we're hearing here about whether the legislature should do this by statute. And there is also the possibility that this issue becomes something that is debated in the context of a case in controversy. But there's also reasonable reason to think that these are rules that are appropriately considered as criminal rules adopted by the Supreme Court because they relate directly to the court's operation. So I leave you with that information, and we will carry on this debate July 1. But the fundamental question for the Rules Committee is whether it wants to weigh in on this and make a recommendation to the Supreme Court, make multiple or alternative recommendations to the Supreme Court, and then ask the Supreme Court to either establish a rule or not based upon the debate that were taking place. But I wanted to be sure that we're having this conversation in the context of what's actually happening. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but I believe that almost no other districts in the state are using grand jury proceedings for indictments. It's, at least it's very, 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 very rare. Is that right?
That's correct. Most of the jurisdictions are required by law to impanel a grand jury to investigate local governments, and as part of that, they do also have the opportunity to hear presentations for indictments. So, but there's no other full-time criminal grand juries outside of Clark and Washington.
Okay. All right. Does anybody want to offer any additional comment, or can we defer the rest of this conversation to July 1?
Justice Hardesty, I had a question.
Yes.
Well, I have two questions. One is that frequently when I see the state go back and indict someone after they've already been to justice court, the charges are different. So in that sense, I do think they are entitled to a new bail hearing immediately because the charges are different. Sometimes they've added on a lot more charges, or maybe they've changed the charges. So that was one thing I was thinking about.
But in those cases, Sharon, is the bail different?
You know, that I don't know. I'd have to go back and look, and it's not something I kept track of, so I wouldn't know.
Because what the district court judges are saying, and what I'm understanding is to be the case even in the second, is that there's been bail set and that the judge who's hearing the return of the indictment, the true bill, is setting bail consistent with what the bail was set in justice court. Now, I don't know, Judge Jones, if that's the practice in cases in which you've heard a true bill or whether Judge Bell does the same thing. But even though the charges have changed or maybe additional charges have been added, are you adjusting the bail from that which was set in justice court?
And Justice Hardesty, it's my understanding, I've done grand jury returns a couple times. Judge Bell handles a majority of those, but it's my understanding mostly the bail remains the same as it was in justice court. And if the state is seeking to increase that bail that is put in front of the district court judge that case is going to be assigned to. Judge Bell, it's a very rare occasion that she is raising bails during the grand jury returns. That's pretty much a common thing, and the state knows that when they go in front of her. So every time I've ever done it, the state is immediately letting me know what the bail was set at in justice court, because it has become common practice that that's where the bail will remain until it's reviewed by the district court judge that is assigned to.
Mr. Emley, Mr. Arascotta, is your information different than that?
No, it's not.
Okay. I'm sorry, Sharon, you had
one clarification. Justice, one clarification is if we're talking about the adversarial hearing described by Valdez-Jimenez, or are we talking about the first hearing set by review by the district court judge without defense counsel, without the defendant present?
Well, I think part of the problem, Darren, there is that Valdez has only been out a short period of time. So. Right. You don't know yet how many times the defendant will have been in front of or had an opportunity to request or have hearings in front of the justice court. The justice court judges are having a webinar on Friday to go through many of these issues themselves in order to get their arms around how to address these contested hearings in justice court. And so it's unclear. But I think the main point I was concerned about in responding to Sharon's comment is that if the charges go up, it doesn't mean the bail changes. or the detention status changes. When I was a chief judge in the Second Judicial District and we had similar situations, I didn't change the defendant's detention status unless requested by the district attorney who was reporting the true bill with the foreman. And in those cases, there were reasons offered for that. But I gotta tell you, as I sit here now, I can't remember a single instance in which I changed it as chief judge. I won't say I didn't, but I sure don't remember it much. Is Judge Freeman on board yet with this meeting?
Something.
Is he in?
No, doesn't look like it.
Okay. Sharon, you were going to make an additional point, and then we'll move on.
Right. The other question I've had about this is that I think it's going to be affected not only through indictments, but bench warrants. I mean, as you've already stated, that a lot of our past clients haven't had this thorough hearing. So if there's bench warrants that are out there, once they get picked up and are back in district court, they would be entitled to a hearing.
Okay. All right, then would everybody please turn your attention to Rule 14, Tab 4. Mr. Arascotta provided some slight amendments to that. I had an opportunity, or I wanted to have Judge Herndon have an opportunity to take a look at this rule and its amendment to make sure that it his views were taken into account. And unless there's any additional comment or question about Rule 14, we're operating on the draft that is found at page 17 and 18, excuse me, 17, my apologies, of your material. This draft, just to refresh everybody's memory, extends to the trial judge the discretionary authority to determine what remedy, if any, will be exercised in the event documents are submitted later than the 3-day judicial day cutoff for the submission of documents for sentencing. All right, let's take a poll, Jamie, on the...
Oh, Justice Hardesty, I had a few comments if I could be heard.
Okay, Sharon.
You know, I looked at this rule again, and I'm still concerned about what I call the 3-day rule. And I'm concerned because it conflicts, in my opinion, with NRS 176.015 subsection 2, which states, before imposing sentence, the court shall address the defendant personally and ask the defendant if the defendant wishes to make a statement in his or her own behalf and to present any information, mitigation, or punishment. And the way it conflicts is that this rule with the 3 days allows the court to perhaps disregard what is in fact mitigation in the form of punishment. We just had a new U.S. Supreme Court case come down today. Though it was a death penalty case and involved a penalty hearing, I think that you know, what it has to say is important, and that is that if you know the defense counsel doesn't present the evidence in mitigation, you know, they're ineffective. They can be found ineffective. And so when I look at this, I see that you know, an attorney could forget the date for 3 days, or they could have it incorrectly logged, or they could just misplace something on their desk. And then if the court says, well, wait a minute, you didn't do it in 3 days, I think I'm going to, in the interest of justice, refuse to consider it. You know, I think there's a problem where the case is going to come back because the attorney didn't properly present it. But more importantly, I think the judge needs to consider everything that's in mitigation.
Okay. Any other comments on this, on 14? All right, Jamie, let's take a poll on this one.
Okay. Justice Hardesty?
I vote yes on Rule 14 as modified by Mr. Arascotta.
Okay. Justice Silver?
I vote yes, as stated by Justice Hardesty.
Thank you. Justice Stiglitch?
I vote yes.
Thank you. John Arascotta?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Freeman is not here. Judge Herndon?
Yes, ma'am. With thanks to John for making those modifications.
Thank you. Luke Prengeman is proxy for Chris Hicks.
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay?
No, based on the comments of Ms. Dickinson.
Okay, thank you. Mark Jackson?
Yes.
Thank you. Lisa Rasmussen?
No.
Thank you. Judge Shirley?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. John Springate?
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay is proxy for Jonelle Thomas?
No.
Thank you. And Chris Lawley is proxy for Steve Wolfson?
Yes.
Thank you. The yeses have it.
Okay, let's turn now to the rule on motions to continue trial settings, Rule 15, under tab number
five.
On pages 19, or page 19, I should say. This rule went through a lot of transformation, but essentially, my understanding from our last meeting was that most everyone was in agreement. I think we deferred this so that everybody have a final opportunity to read through the various redlinings and additions that have been made. Thank you, Mr. Prengeman, for working through this with others. Are there any comments on Rule 15?
Your Honor, I have a comment.
Okay.
Your Honor, the only thing I was concerned about was in Section B1, removing the wording, the length of time the witness has been absent. And my concern is that that's an important part for the motion to continue. And specifically, if you look at the Joseph John H. case, where in that case the victim had not returned her subpoena, had apparently moved, and they knew she had moved for at least a week, that was part of the thing that the district court or the magistrate took into consideration when deciding whether or not good cause was there. So I think that that should be included, that language. So if somebody knows when the how long the witness has been absent, that they include that in the affidavit.
Let me ask you this, Sharon. Doesn't the language that's at the very end of the sentence subsume the language that you are concerned about that was stricken earlier?
That tells us the length of the time the witness will be unavailable. So maybe she's available 2 days from now, but she's not available now. But that language, if you leave the other language in, then the person asking for continuance has to say, well, they've been absent for a week, 2 weeks. And then the question is, well, why didn't you file the motion sooner? Or why didn't you let everybody else sooner? So I think it's an important thing to be considered. You may not always know how long they've been absent, but if you do, it should be included.
Anyone wish to comment or respond to that?
Just as hard as you, this is Mark Jackson. I think subsection 4 covers that. That's where we would inform the court either orally or in the motion as to when they first learned of the absence. The length of time that a witness has been absent is not relevant. What is relevant is when the defense attorney or when the prosecution learned of their absence. And that is being brought to the court's attention from subsection B4.
Anyone else want to comment on this issue? All right, hearing none, Jamie, let's take a poll on this one.
Okay.
This is Rule 15 as modified by Mr. Pringleman on page 19.
Okay. Justice Hardesty?
Yes.
Justice Silver?
Yes.
Justice Stiglitch?
Yes.
Thank you. John Arascotta?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Freeman, have you joined us? No. Judge Herndon?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Luke Pringleman is proxy for Chris Hicks?
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay?
Yes.
Thank you. Mark Jackson?
Yes.
Thank you. Lisa Rasmussen?
Yes.
Thank you. Judge Shirley?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. John Springate?
Yes.
Thank you. Darren Imlay is proxy for Jonelle Thomas?
Yes.
Thank you. And Chris Lawley is proxy for Steve Wolfson?
Yes.
Thank you. Yeses have it.
All right. Could everybody please turn to item E on the agenda, Rule 2, under tab 6. You will recall that we had a discussion about this subject and these rules early on in our committee meetings.
A year ago. Last June.
I'm trying to get, I hate the thought that we would have to go beyond a year on this. There was a general consensus that had emerged, is my recollection, that subject to consultation with Judge Bell, the requirement in the Second Judicial District Court's provision of the rule for random assignments was something that everybody agreed was appropriate. There was a couple of twists to it, and we have minutes showing that. So I don't want to revisit all of that, but I don't know whether Judge Herndon, you or Mr. Lawley or anybody, nobody was specifically assigned that I recall, had an opportunity to confer with Judge Bell about this case assignment rule. Do you recall, Doug, if you had a chance to visit with her about this?
No, and I apologize if that was something that
I'm not saying that you were assigned with it. Okay. I just am asking if you recall any discussion about it.
I don't believe I did. I'm happy to do that. I have to have a lot of conversations with her, including Tiara Jones here, coming up in the next couple of weeks. as we prepare a lot of things, and I'll be happy to chat with her about it, but I have not so far, no sir.
Could you do this for me? Would you please, and I'll ask Jamie to make it, I know you've probably got a lot of paper you're working with, but we'll shoot you an email that has copies of the segment of the minutes that dealt with this discussion. I think it occurred over a couple of meetings.
Okay.
And if you could take a look at those, we'll send copies to you, Judge Jones, as well. And could you all please take a look at these rules that are set out here? Fundamentally, the question was the random assignment, providing for the random assignment of cases.
Right.
But there were a couple of areas. One area in particular had to do with how would the group that you preside over, Judge Herndon, handle this? How would that be implicated? That was one area I recall. Okay. Another area had to do with how do we handle cases in which there were already pending cases against a defendant, and
right.
How does that work? And so in order to avoid a potential conflict with your district or any of the districts for that matter, I think we wanted to make sure that the general requirement of random assignment also took into account input from you folks about how that rule would operate if we adopted this as a statewide rule.
Okay.
And for the rest of the group, I think Mark and Judge Shirley, we were generally on board with the Second Judicial District Court Rule 2, as I remember. But again, I'm going from memory, so everybody else, if you'll refresh your memory, we're going to raise this issue as the second issue on July 1 to try to get this one squared away.
Very good.
And then if I could turn, did anybody have any additional comments about Rule 2? Am I missing something about it that we previously discussed that the judges should have in mind when they visit with the Chief Judge
Justice
of the
8th? Hardesty?
Yes, Chris?
Is it contemplated there's going to be a draft of this rule that we can consider? It's one thing to talk sort of philosophically and in general terms about, yeah, we like this idea or we like that, but until you actually see a rule, I think it's a lot easier to sort of ferret through it.
I agree with you, Chris. The drafts that we're working from are the 8th Judicial District Rule 3.10 and the 2nd Judicial District Court Rule 2. It was contemplated that there would be some drafting once we got input from Judge Bell, so I'm trying to circle back to that so that I can, after we have that input, put together a rule that everybody can then debate.
Thank you.
Justice Hardesty, it's Lisa. I had thought that kind of where we left off, and maybe I'm wrong, is that in the 8th, we supported random reassignment, but you wanted to check with Judge Bell, and that the tension was that in the 2nd Judicial District, they have essentially vertical assignment once someone has a criminal case, like they have a judge for life. I kind of thought that's where we were. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say for life, but with any pending case. And I thought that we had some conversation about how that wasn't productive in the 8th, but maybe I'm wrong.
That's my understanding as well, Lisa.
Justice Hardesty, this is John Arascata. That's my recollection also was one, to maintain randomness, and then the issue was up here in the 2nd, we used what we call the one judge rule, and whether that works in the 8th judicial or not was kind of the cliffhanger.
So I know from the district attorney standpoint, we're in favor of the one judge rule, so I don't think it was settled by everyone, and I think, Justice, you're correct in we sort of left things with Judge Bell to determine from her standpoint how that could be implemented or if it could be implemented.
Judge Herndon, Judge Jones, do you understand that issue? I'm sure you understand the issue, but I just wanted to highlight it.
Look, I think there can be a lot of wisdom to it. I frequently have situations where I'm taking a plea and the defendant may have 3 or 4 pending cases, and I'll offer to the attorneys, why don't we just consolidate all of them into my court if you would like, or you can consolidate them into somebody else's court if you like, particularly when you have stipulated sentences, just so it's a lot easier to manage the cases. So I don't have any problem with that. I didn't talk to her particularly about it. I know it's something that's kind of been on the table before as well. So I'm sure it's something she's thought a little bit about.
So that it's now time to bring that to a head if we can.
Sure.
And okay. By the way, if you get an indication before the July 1 meeting, let me know, and
okay,
we'll see if we can't get a rule draft to move this conversation along and get something circulated before the July 1 meeting.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
And then if we could turn everybody's attention to tab 7, which is Rule 4, there may be some other issues that are controversial in this rule, but the question, and we talked about this also, is there a problem, or are there any problems with this rule? And my request on Rule 4 is this, and I don't want to duplicate our debate over Rule 8H. So to the extent that this rule is addressing detention questions or detention issues, ignore that for the moment. What I'm trying to determine is whether Rule 4 is a rule that is acceptable to the committee for consideration on July 1, or are there edits that you would like to see made to this rule, and I'm requesting that you submit any suggested edits to Rule 4, except the detention provisions, prior to the July 1 meeting. Are you with me on that? So again, this is the process that takes place in initial appearance and an arraignment. There's one other area that I think is going to be important to think about here, and that is the extent to which subsection B is impacted by AB 236 and the procedures that district court judges will be expected to take into account when looking at diversions and specialty court transfers under AB 236. So I highlight that so that we can further discuss that process in the context of this rule. So to summarize, we'll be taking this up as the third item on July 1. If you have edits, suggested edits, or concerns, please submit them in advance of July 1, and with the exception, of course, of what would probably be specifically subsection A6. But we also need to talk about the extent to which AB 236 and the diversionary provisions in that statute influence the provisions of subsection B and what transpires at the initial appearance where a plea is taken. Does anybody have any questions regarding that request? Chris, were you going to comment or? No, okay. No. I'm sorry, I thought you were leaning in to make an observation. All right. That said, I had promised that these meetings would be about an hour and 15 minutes or so. We're an hour and 16 or 17 minutes into the mission. So we will end today's work and pick up again on July 1. One caveat. There may be a special session on June 29th or 30th. I don't know for sure. If that should happen, we'll let you know, but I'm hoping that if there is, we'll be done, and that won't affect the July 1st date for this committee. As you can see, in terms of our remaining work from this material, there are still a couple of outstanding areas of subject matters, one dealing with grand jury access for information and the other having to do with the jury commissioner's responsibilities. I'm deferring those until we can get these basic rules squared away, and then we'll take those up before we finish this round of work for the committee. Okay, any questions or comments before we conclude today? Okay, thanks everybody. I really appreciate your comments and your input, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the 1st and hear from you in the meantime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.